What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and you know what's more American than America's 250th birthday? Supporting American-owned companies like SpinQuest, America's number one social casino with over 1,000 games like Live Dealer Blackjack and Craps. They're offering new users a $30 coin package for just $10. Go to SpinQuest.com and sign up today.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
The 1958 Christmas holiday was quickly approaching, and the Martin family of five set out on a quiet Sunday drive to collect greenery for their holiday decorations. They waved goodbye to their neighbors, never to return. Months later, the bodies of two of the children, Susan and her older sister Virginia, were found in Oregon's Columbia River, but the rest of the family was never found. Their sudden, mysterious disappearance sparked decades of rumors and whispers, many of which may now finally be laid to rest with a shocking new development. A potential discovery of their car. Could this lead to the answers that have eluded investigators for over six decades? This is their story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes by Jane.
At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
Vanessa, we actually don't do a lot in covering, like, news stories on this podcast. Like, we're not a breaking news podcast.
Like, current news? Yeah, we don't usually cover that.
No, so, like, we're not
Have we ever?
No. Because, like, our methodology is a little bit different. Like, we do different types of research and storytelling and emphasis on missing persons cases and unidentified persons cases. So it's like very rarely that we have anything that's like currently happening.
Right.
Plus, like, there's like the like our process of like there's a poem, we get a reader, everything like that. So
is today going to be different?
Today is different. I'm actually going to read the poem at the end so that we take away some of that process of, you know, the time that it takes to get a guest reader in. Just because this is current news, I am fascinated by this story. This episode is different, and I just want to talk about it. So, it is both an older case and a current events case at the same time. And now, if our listeners know, like, I love a good spreadsheet, and this disappearance was on my list for over a year. And because it takes place in December, I thought, like, we would cover this case in December. And then I decided not to cover this case because there was a new development in this story. If our listeners subscribe to our newsletter, Girl Hunt, they likely already know what I'm talking about because I wrote about this in my recent Girl Hunt newsletter. It's about the disappearance of the Martin family, which included mom, dad, and three daughters in 1958. And last week, they thought they had located their car. So it seems fitting to cover in the newsletter, right? Rather than the podcast?
Right. Also, I don't know. Have we ever talked about a whole family?
We have not talked about
like sets of sisters.
Sisters, yes.
And maybe mother and daughter. Mm-hmm. We've never talked about an entire family
before. This is an entire family.
Yeah. Okay.
So basically there was a new development in the case and I decided it would be better to write about in the newsletter. But then things went down differently than I thought. So we're covering their story now. And we're covering the update. And we're talking about the investigation into their disappearance. So yeah. As we're recording this, it is Friday, March 14th, and we are airing this episode on Tuesday, March 18th, right? So, this is a different turnaround for us entirely. And, I'll keep people posted about any new developments over on my newsletter, Girl Hunt, so consider subscribing. But this is, like, kind of breaking news, and I am eager to find it.
Can you tell our listeners how to subscribe to your newsletter just in case they can't find it?
Right. Okay. So yeah, it's called Girl Hunt. And if you just go over to girlhuntmedia.com, it will take you directly there and you can subscribe. And basically you get a newsletter from me at least every other week, usually every week, covering other types of cases and current news and broader issues about missing persons or crime, and also new book releases I write about. So it's a mix, but they're all related to like women and crime, like the intersection of those. Yeah. So that was a long way of saying I have talked about this elsewhere. I still want to talk about it. I'm bringing it to the podcast.
That's and you're just going to keep talking about it until you can't talk about it anymore.
Yes.
We're going to do all the talking.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
So let's talk.
On Sunday, May 3rd, 1959, on the Columbia River, a river that runs between Oregon and Washington, it was running high with spring runoff. Tugboat operator Charles Isman was maneuvering the R.W. Confer through the water. Charles was on board with two other crew members, Don Monham and logger Cecil Coburn, and they were about a mile out from the Crown Zellerbach Corporation paper factory where they all worked.
That was a mouthful.
That was the Crown Zellerbach Corporation paper factory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, spotting a flash of something in the river, something compelled Charles to bring the boat over for a closer look. He is one of those guys.
I am one of those guys. You are not one of those guys.
I am like, I see nothing. I see nothing.
And I'm like, I need to look.
Yes. He needed to look. He is like, what is that? I'm going to go check it out.
Yes. Right.
And that's when he spotted the body. Speaking with reporters soon after, the 39-year-old Isman would say, "It really didn't look like a body when I first saw it, but something made me want to go get a close look. As I got close, I could see legs and then an arm. I eased the body around and then went back to pick up my crew." Now, Charles had radioed in to Harry Shekla on a two-way radio and told him what they'd found. Though she was floating on her side and her face was covered by her shirt and coat, it appeared to be a young girl in the water. Shekla alerted authorities, who were quickly on their way to this area near Camas, Washington. Meanwhile, Isman said he towed the body onto a log raft, which is a collection of floating logs that are caught up in the spring water, and Dawn remained behind, securing her body to the log raft while Charles and Cecil went back to get authorities. Soon, Charles and Cecil ushered over a smaller survey boat containing Clark County Sheriff Clarence McKay and Coroner Paul Mylan to the spot in the river. McKay and Mylan caught a glimpse of red and white petal pushers and knew whose body they were seeing. Placing her body into a bag, they brought her aboard the survey boat. And once on land, she was transported to a funeral parlor about 10 miles away. Within hours, the body would be identified as 10-year-old Susan Martin, still dressed in the clothing she was last seen in 5 months earlier when she and her entire family disappeared from Portland, Oregon in December. They'd last been seen leaving their family home, and friends knew they planned to leave the city and head out to get some Christmas greenery to decorate their home with.
That's what you mean by only part of them were found?
Yes. Yeah. So only a few of the family members were found, one of which was Susan. Now, because it had been so long, Susan's uncle didn't recognize her features when he was called to view her body. He and his wife were also unsure about the clothing, not recognizing it immediately. Instead, it took her family's dentist to examine her teeth to assure investigators that they were right in thinking that this was Susan. There, in her 8 fillings, the dentist saw his patient, Susan Martin.
Now, how come the other man was so certain it was her by her pants? And then the uncle is like, oh, I don't really know if I recognize these clothes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know exactly. I know that, you know, all the investigators in this area had known the Martin family was missing and had likely just been, like, staring at the descriptions of what they were last seen in for a while. So, like, when he saw red and white, he was like,
he went right there. He knew right away.
It's got to be this kid, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I think, you know, for the uncle, like, he's having to go view a body that had been in the water for quite a while. So I think, like, the trauma of that experience, like, I can't even.
And also without the rest of his family being there, he might want to just deny it and be like, this is a different
right,
girl.
Yeah, so, like, I don't know.
Right.
Like, yeah. Now, the discovery of Susan's body was only the beginning to solving a mystery of what happened to the entire Martin family, but at least they knew that all this time Susan had been in the water. Now, the next day, just after 11 a.m., Clarence Haight, who was a veteran electrician for the U.S. Army Engineers, was walking on the Bonneville Dam. This is almost 25 miles upstream from where Susan was found. As he walked around the spillway side of the dam, north of Bradford Island, he was checking on the gantry cranes. It's there he caught sight of something floating in the debris by bay number 15 of the spillway. Crane operators were lowered down to the water in one of the cranes, and 12-year-old Virginia Martin was gently scooped out of the water and into a wire basket. At first, Virginia was mistaken for her older sister, Barbara, but she was soon identified as the middle sister by her dark hair. She's the only sister with the dark hair. Like her little sister, Susan, her body was also still intact, but had as well experienced decomposition. She was still clothed in her jeans. Her jeans were still like rolled up into pedal pushers, and she had some M&M wrappers tucked into her pockets. With this discovery, investigators had made a new important discovery in their attempts to locate the Martin family. Many had already assumed that the family had somehow tragically entered the river when they disappeared in December. The discovery of Susan's body the day before had everyone questioning if they ended up in the water further downstream, but the Columbia River wasn't as deep there. Old-timers assumed that they'd have seen the car the family had been in down that way if that was the case, since the water wasn't high enough to hide the car.
Okay, so is the car missing too?
Yeah, so the car is
the entire family and their car?
Yeah. So at this point, they're like, they've assumed when they went missing, like maybe they're in the river, one of the rivers, right? So then this helps them to be like, where in the river?
Right, like where do these girls come from?
Yeah. So this has helped them confirm, okay, it is likely there's a car in the river, right? And it is, you know, helping them pinpoint where exactly this might have happened. So they know it has to be upstream from where the two girls were found. Yeah. So now with Virginia, she's found before the dam. So everyone knew that they had to be looking further up from there. So it's clear everyone thought that they'd soon learn what happened to this family of five. I'm going to tell you a little bit, or a lot, a bit, about the Martin family.
Right. I'm curious now.
Yeah, because, you know, I think we're going to get into some, like, weirdness. I know the story already feels a little bit weird.
It feels really weird already.
Yeah. As we go along, and I think that we kind of, we're going to lose sight of who the Martin family was, like, collectively. And I just, yeah, you know, our podcast really emphasizes that. So we're going to start there. Now, the Martin family disappearance, this had captured the nation's attention from the beginning. On Sunday, December 7th, 1958, Kenneth Martin, who is 54, and his wife Barbara, 48, and their three daughters, Barbara, Virginia, and Susan, had been spending a typical Sunday at home. That morning, the family had been, like, in their small Northeast 56th Avenue house. Now, the family had long outgrown this house. They'd purchased it back in 1932, and back then, it had just been a family of three. Ken, Barbara, and their toddler son, Donald. Are you wondering just because I added in a
new
child?
Yeah, like, where's Donald?
Donald's older. Donald's an older
Okay, so kid. He didn't go missing?
No, Donald's not missing.
Okay.
Now, by the time Donald was a teenager, Ken and Barbara decided to have three more children. So,
okay.
Yeah, there's a significant age gap, like 14 years between him and
the next. I just needed to wait. You always end up giving me the information, but I always want it sooner.
Now.
Yeah.
Right. So they welcomed first Barbara, who, you know, is named after her mom, but I'm going to refer to her here as Barbie, which was her nickname. I tend not to use people's nicknames, but, like, this helps differentiate Barbara 1 and Barbara 2.
Okay.
And then they had Virginia and Susan. Now, by the time Donald moved out, they were already busting at the seams in this little house, like, but they loved their house. And they loved their neighborhood. In fact, the block that they lived on between Hancock and Broadway was unofficially known as Candy Cane Lane, because if there's one thing that Ken was serious about, it was Christmas.
So he was just all out.
He was the Christmas guy. Like, one year he constructed large plywood candy canes that the girls helped paint, and then he distributed these to each of his neighbors on the block to display for the holiday season. And he kept, like, this tradition going. Like, he would distribute these decorations every year, and that's how their little block became known as Candy Cane Lane. That Sunday, the holiday was just on the horizon. The night before, Ken and Barbara had gone to a holiday party, and Ken had worn his Santa suit. Like, he often...
He's really into this.
He's so into it. Right. He played Santa at various holiday occasions, like particularly for the neighborhood. And apparently, like everyone, like the little kids, like legit believed this was Santa.
He was it, right?
Like he's just kind of like this like jolly kind of guy figure, right? That morning, the Santa suit was still like draped over the chair in the living room, and the three girls were reading the funny section of the newspaper in their kitchen alcove. Like it was a pretty like chill morning. But their morning was broken up by the visit of their good friends, Mr. and Mrs. Evans, who brought their two children, as well as 7-year-old Marcy Welch. While the adults visited, the children scattered. Some of them went and played in the backyard. You know, the adults were having their adult conversation time. And at some point, though, Marcy, she decides to call her mother. And then in the process, Barbara and Marcy's mother end up having a brief phone conversation. Now, Mrs. Arden Welch asked Barbara if the Martin family planned on going with the Evans and the Welches for their typical Sunday dinner. They often had Sunday dinner together all the time, right? But Barbara declined, saying that they planned on going to collect some Christmas greenery. Now, I've seen this question asked so many times online in the last few days about what Christmas greenery is, but it is just literally going and collecting like tree boughs to put on mantles and to make into wreaths for the holiday. You know, before like we had like the plastic version.
Right. So instead of running to Walmart, are they like going into the woods to do this?
They're like, we're going to go chop some tree branches or collect some. Yeah. Now, when the Evans family departed, Barbara took some hamburger meat out from the fridge and she placed it on the counter. Outside, Ken was wrestling to remove the third row of their 1954 Ford Country Squire station wagon. Capable of seating 9, this is a spacious car that was actually one of their prized possessions. In fact, Barbara had been able to get it for them kind of through a prize win. Like, Barbara was a veteran of the product contest circuit.
So she's way into contests and he's way into Christmas. They sound like a lot of fun.
Right. So like, okay. So back in the day.
Like real 1950s fun happening here.
It is like straight up. Like they are like the, in many ways, the quintessential stereotypical 1950s family. Like they're having like, you know, they would perform plays on their front yard. Like there'd be like talent competitions in the neighborhood. It's like kind of like what people are visualizing the 1950s to be like.
Just the good parts.
Just the good parts. We're going to get into some of the bad parts in a second. But Barbara, she entered product contests. So if people don't know, basically companies would host like these competitions for things like you could submit jingles or ad copy or even like little mini essays. And they're often like their own products were the prize. So this is how Barbara had gotten the family all sorts of like household appliances. In fact, like the family like famously didn't have a television yet because they were just waiting for Barbara to win one.
That's awesome.
Yeah. But you know, Barbara had won a bunch of other things with her contest skills. Like they took a trip to Cuba, just her and Ken. Like they got an all-inclusive paid trip to Cuba. And also she won a Jeep.
Okay.
Yeah. So like the Jeep win was quite spectacular. There's like this adorable photo of the entire family, including Don, like packed into this like Jeep.
Right.
Right. But it's like not practical for their family structure. Right. So it's like a large family. So they decided, you know, the best course of action here was to trade it in for the station wagon.
It makes sense.
And it should be not surprising that this is like very holiday themed. Like the car is in cream with red accents and a red interior.
Okay.
Yeah.
So everything is just decked out red and white or red and cream at this point.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, I don't know if they picked it for that reason, but like when I think about it, I'm like, oh, like a candy cane.
Perfect.
Right? Yeah. So Ken, though, he was ever like a safety-minded individual. So he had actually installed aftermarket seatbelts in it to keep his family safe, right? So he's the safety 1950s dad kind of guy, right? So, but that afternoon, the family doesn't need the extra seating. They need room for like all the Christmas greenery they're planning on gathering. So like they take out that extra seat, right? Now, pulling out of the driveway that afternoon, the Martin family honked cheerfully at some neighborhood teens before heading on their way. Like, it feels like a movie, right?
Your script does not seem like real life.
Oh, because it just, like, feels cinematic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It feels very much like you've written a story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that just, this is what it feels like.
Yeah, right? That's what it feels like.
Yeah, so like, yeah, the honking, the kids are like waving from the back seat.
Right? I'm just like picturing some like clean cut 1950s celebrity pulling out and being like, hiya, kids, yes. At the teenagers outside.
Basically, that's okay. What it feels like, right? Like the teens, though, they didn't know when they saw the family. They just like knew that they saw them. But one of the neighborhood people, she's Ella Chin. She lives actually several doors down. She thought she saw them leave around 2 p.m. And she noticed that like Virginia was getting in the car wearing her like red boots. Like, of course.
Mm-hmm. Right? This is really cute.
Yeah. And then like Frank Womack, he lived across the street. So he's the neighbor across the street. He swore it was like closer to 1:30. And he said he saw Ken with like two cameras like around his neck. Like,
I love these people.
I think some of that is going to fade in a little bit.
Oh, no.
I mean, okay, they are very lovely people in many ways, but I think the...
Are you setting me up to just, like, crush me?
No. I mean, I think when we... I think right now is, like, a good time to really analyze, like, what we think of the 1950s and... Like, there's this cute aspect, right?
Right, but it's very surface level, too. Like, if you actually, like, do research into that time or watch any historically accurate things from that time. Everything was meant to look so good.
Yeah.
But then there's all this other stuff that we keep hiding all of these other mm-hmm. things. Is that what's happening here?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, they are adorable. They are also, though, a product of the 1950s.
Right.
Like, and also, like, white 1950s, to be mm-hmm. honest. Like, so he's got his, like, two, like, cameras around his neck. It's, like, adorable. They are all adorable, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, yeah. Whatever the case may be, whether it was 1:30 or 2, we're kind of in that kind of zone of the afternoon. Mm-hmm. And we know that they, like, left their neighborhood and headed off. Now, the next day, Monday, December 8th. Taylor Eccles, who's Ken's boss at Eccles Electric, he arrives to work around 7:30, 7:40 in the morning, and he's surprised to see that the service truck that Ken drove to and from work and on calls, like, wasn't there. Ken was a service manager at Eccles, and he was always punctual. In fact, he actually usually made it there before Taylor. Furthermore, Taylor knew that Ken had a meeting at 8 a.m., and it really was not like him not to be there and prepared ahead of time, because, like, that's the Ken kind of way of being, mm-hmm. right? Meanwhile, over at Rose City School, fifth grader Susan and seventh grader Virginia were marked absent from school. Now, word of their absence drifted its way over to second grade teacher Charlotte Dorsey. Charlotte knew the girls not just as students. She was their aunt. Ken was her brother. So Charlotte was immediately worried. Like, while the family occasionally went out on trips together, it wasn't like Ken not to notify her in advance if they were spending longer somewhere. And so she was worried that something could be wrong if both girls were absent mm-hmm. at the same time. Now, Charlotte phoned the high school, Ulysses S. Grant High School, and learned that Barbie hadn't shown up for her ninth grade class either. While this all seemed unusual, Charlotte didn't report anything. After all, like, it could be possible that something came up and she would just, like, hear about it later. Now, that evening, a man named Edward Lenz ends up calling the police on behalf of Taylor Eccles, Ken's boss. He reports that Ken and his family were likely missing. So probably in the meantime, there were some conversations that were happening, like, where are the Martins?
Where are the rest of them? Yeah.
Now, Edward said that there was a possibility that the family had gone to Larch Mountain, which was a popular destination for getting trees or holiday greenery for those who lived in the Portland area. By that evening, police were searching the small family home, having gotten Charlotte to let them into the residence. Everything appeared exactly as though the Martin family had simply stepped out, anticipating to be back shortly. Like, laundry was still in the washing machine, the mail and papers were out on the table, and the Santa suit that Ken had was, like, still draped over the chair. While police were searching the home, others had been sent out to Larch Mountain area to see if the family could be spotted out that way. No one knew exactly where the family was headed that day, so the search really started on the places people typically went to get Christmas trees or greenery, and also area trails that the, like, Martin family used. But these initial searches didn't turn up anything. Now, soon after, though, their story hit the paper, and thankfully before it did, Charlotte was able to call the Martin family's son, Donald, who was living in an apartment with two other men in New York City and serving in the Navy at Fort Schuyler Hospital. Donald would actually hear the news on the radio shortly after, so his aunt's call came just in time. He would later say, That would have been hell of a way to have gotten the news.
It really would have. I mean, imagine your whole family going missing, and what can you do about it?
Yeah. So he's 28 at this point. He's living in New York City, right?
Just like, completely helpless to the fact that his entire family is gone.
Yeah. So they're all, like, just all at once, right? Ugh. Yeah. And, like, kind of him saying, like, oh, imagine finding out via the radio. It kind of reminds me of, like, now when people are, like, posting about, like, crime and news on, like, Facebook and stuff. And you're just like, oh, imagine finding
like,
out.
Maybe, like, maybe, like, wait.
Wait. Wait a minute. Hold up.
Wait until there's actually news out and then talk about it. Yeah.
Now, Donald, he had last spoken to his family on the phone on Thanksgiving Day, but he'd gotten a letter from his mom the week before. Like, she wrote regularly every 5 days or so. This feels like a very regimented family. But he didn't find anything unusual or amiss in the letter that she had sent. So he wasn't any help in, like, forming an understanding of where his parents and his sisters were. Now, no one knew where exactly the Martin family was headed that day, but later reports placed them in several locations over 60 miles away from their home in Portland. Seeing the story in the news, a waitress named Clara York claimed that she had served them in Hood River at the Paradise Snack Bar just before dusk on the night they had left home. Okay. Now, she said that the girls had wanted a soda, but their father told them no, that they had to have milk. Right. And she said, like, the girls, she served them hamburgers and fries and a dessert. And the family stayed for about an hour before leaving and heading west in the direction of Portland. Like many eyewitnesses we talk about, Clara's story was under question, right? Like, after all, like, we know plenty of stories of eyewitness accounts. Like, they just got things wrong, right? Mm-hmm. So 2 weeks after the family disappeared, a credit card receipt actually arrives in their mailbox at the Martin house. It's for 5 gallons of gas at Dean's Chevron service station in the town of Cascade Locks, which is 40 miles east of Portland. So Hood River is east of Cascade Locks, about 20 miles, right? So while it's still not clear that if Clara had, like, seen them for certain, like, they were at least documented as having been in that direction. So unfortunately, the gas receipt didn't have a timestamp or note on it about when the transaction occurred.
So what exactly is under question? They just don't believe that she saw them. Yes. They believe she saw, like, some other family.
Yeah. So, like, you know, are you making it up?
Was it a different family?
Like, yeah.
Huh. Okay.
I mean, you would think that they would just be like, whoa, that's the one eyewitness, like, we've got. Right. Yeah. But no, like, her story was under question. Which I get, because, like, actually, you know, a lot of the stories we talk about where it's like, I saw them. Right. Like, yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's easier to say that about one girl.
I mean, not a whole entire family.
But yeah. maybe, I don't know. So we don't know.
But that's Clara's story. So at the very least, this credit card receipt says they were in that area abouts, right? Now, over the month of December, hundreds of people searched for the family, included aerial searches. Airplanes flew over vast swaths of Oregon and Washington's wilderness as searchers hoped to catch a glimpse of the family's vehicle. At the time, the Sandy and Clackamas Rivers, those were noted to be muddy and turned up with debris and sediment. Like, it's December, so of course. But the Columbia, they said, was relatively clear, and they hoped to be able to spot the car if it had gone in the river. They even sent in divers and used, like, grappling hooks from boats, hoping to hook onto the station wagon if it was underwater. By this point as well, a $1,000 reward is being offered. This drew in fortune hunters as well as Good Samaritans. One man was even, like, walking, like, 300 miles of the Columbia River looking for them. But still, there's no sign of the car or the family. But one person who is notably absent from all of these searches is Donald.
He doesn't go help?
No. So there's, like, in an unusual decision, Donald opts not to return home after learning of the disappearance of his entire family.
Huh.
Yeah.
What's he doing?
Stays in New York City.
He just...
Yes. He says he, like, basically he feels that everyone in Oregon is, like, doing what they can. And really, like, his presence isn't going to do anything.
So, I mean, how are you feeling about that? Are you judging him?
I'm a little bit judgy.
What if he has, like, extreme anxiety and just can't bring himself to do it?
Yeah, well.
Do you know more than?
No, I mean, I think it's just, you know, we're going to get into some weirdness here. Okay.
Okay.
Now, by the end of the month, there's still no sign of his family, and he tells reporters, "I'm convinced they're all dead. They led good lives. Father, mother, and my 3 sisters. What else can I say?
Wait, they live good lives, so it's okay if they're dead? Is that what that meant?
Yeah, it is.
That's a weird statement.
That is a weird statement. We have encountered plenty of weird statements in our...
So is that what you mean of it's going to get weird, or is it getting weirder?
I mean, it will get weirder, but like...
Okay. That's the beginning of the weirdness.
Like, maybe just Donald's not great with emotional expression. I mean, this is part of the 1950s right. culture too, right? Okay. But then he formed an opinion that his family would likely be found in the spring, stating, probably next spring, a forester or camper will find their bodies.
Okay. So now we're just going to... We'll hold tight until that happens.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, honestly, like, his statements are so...
Maybe he just really felt like there was nothing he could do. So just Maybe. Like...
And that's just how he deals with it. Yeah. Right. But like his statements rank up there in the weirdness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But according to an investigator who we're going to talk a little bit more about in a minute, his name is Walter Graven. Donald is actually not on good terms with his family.
Okay.
Right. Now, according to Graven's investigation, Donald is essentially the black sheep of the family. While he lived in Oregon, or when he lived there, he worked at a department store called Meyer and Frank. And in 1955, Donald had been accused of stealing $2,000 worth of goods from his place of employment. Now, Donald was caught by a store detective. I mean, this is like a big department store, mm-hmm. like many floors. Right. So this store detective, he takes him before the store managers to explain his theft. And it's kind of in there in explaining like what happened and why happened that Donald expressed and confessed that he was gay and living with another man in Portland. And that this had caused a rift between him and his family.
Well, that makes sense for him not looking for them then.
Yeah.
And for having that kind of like indifference.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is interesting. This is kind of like the other side of like the 1950s.
Right. So he became probably like a family secret.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just kind of like, oh, if you've got this family who's kind of like, it feels cinematic, like this like idealized version of the 1950s. Right. And then like you've got an older son who's trying to come out or live as a gay man.
He probably already did. He's probably, like, given the times, mm-hmm. I wouldn't be surprised if when he was a teenager, they already had their ideas about it, and then they're just like, okay, let's replace him with this other family.
Like, let's have more children.
Let's have more kids, because maybe we'll get a good one this time. Like, yeah. I don't know. I can't blame Donald for what he's saying and mm-hmm. what he's doing at this point. He's good to just keep living his life and let somebody else find them.
You're like,
is that me being too mean about it?
I mean, I think
like life is already like, hard enough without us having to be mean to each other about things we can't help.
Yeah, I mean, I think like, you know, this helps us understand a bit more, I think, why he's like not rushing out there or why, you know, his expressions of grief. I'm not saying that I'm willing to bet, yes, he is grieving his family.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But, like, him and his boyfriend are probably, like, at this point, like, I'm sure.
Oh, they're no longer together.
Oh, they're not together.
No. So okay. He had lived with this man in Portland, and now he's living in New York City.
We'll be back in a moment.
During this investigation, Graven apparently learned that it was Dad Ken who had footed the bill for like the stolen goods, but that after Donald was sent to the East Coast, apparently to like a religious college.
We're going to pray the gay away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it really changes a lot of things, right?
Well, it does. It just changes how I feel about his indifference to it. At first, I was like, oh, maybe mm-hmm. he's just, you know, he might have a high stress job. He might have anxiety about them being missing, or maybe he was treated really badly.
Yeah. Or maybe that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, yeah. Because definitely when I think about this, like, I think about how terrible this was for Donald. Mm-hmm. Like, how, like, he's sent away and the rest of his family is kind of living this, like, storybook kind of picture-perfect life, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, like, this detective, Walter Graven, though, he sees something else. A motive.
Really?
Yeah, so Graven believes that there's more to the story than, like, maybe a potential, like, simple car accident. And he starts to wonder, hey, is Donald involved somehow?
Now, and I already know Donald's not involved because we're not calling him D.
No.
So,
I mean,
so that's least... another unfair judgment. But I mean, at the same time, I can't completely, like, it's hard to completely place judgment on the family because this is what's forced down their throats at this point too, right?
Right.
How to...
And it's like, it's also probably important to know, like, Ken comes from a religious family. His father is involved in, I don't know my religions very well, but like in a ministry. Mm-hmm. And so he's like, that's where like that vein comes in. And then you've got like in the 1950s where it's just like, yeah, plenty of people were gay, but not necessarily out.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not like we have more gay people now.
No, it's just more we have people,
more people are out.
Out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's just like, oh. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, I'm coming at it from, like, a, oh, no, like, I get the family and what's going on there, but also, like, I get Donald.
Yeah, and the family truly thought that that was wrong at that time, probably. And then Donald clearly understands how he should be treated.
Yeah, and he was like,
so, no. I mean, they're at odds with something that neither of them really was equipped to help themselves with at the time, right. I guess. Yeah.
Now, okay, so Graven starts formulating this idea, though. Like, he's suspicious of Donald because, like, Donald's, you know, out there being like, well, they lived a good life. Right. Now,
they'll find them in the spring. That doesn't sound suspicious at all, does it?
Like, oh, Donald.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, there's a few reasons that help support Graven's line of thinking, okay? So it's not just that there's, like, this family rift. Like, first, there's an abandoned vehicle, which is a souped-up 1951 Chevy that's abandoned along the highway near Cascade Locks. Now, witnesses reported seeing it there from around the 8th of December, which is eventually towed 10 days later. This car is unusual. It's, like, obviously because it's got these modifications on it, like, people recognize this car, right? Like, it doesn't fit in with the other cars that people are seeing around, but also, like, it's locked and the keys are still in the ignition. Okay. So it's like got all these suspicious things. With it. Yeah. Now, the car is eventually connected to a man named Lester Price. He's an ex-con who had borrowed a friend's car in Venice, California. If by borrowed you mean he took it and had driven it all the way to Oregon. Now, the assumption is that he's in the area because his wife and child lived there. Now, in his investigation, Craven learned from the Paradise Snack Bar owner that the Martin family weren't the only ones dining at the snack bar that December day. Also there, he claims, was Lester Price and another former convict named Roy Light.
So now they believe her.
Yeah, now they're like, oh.
Oh.
Clara, she was right. Right? Now, or Craven does. He does a lot of legwork on this. Now, Craven starts wondering, these seemingly disconnected things, might they have intersected? Right? This abandoned car maybe just isn't an abandoned car. Now, then there's another clue. Like, reports circulate that a bloody gun was found along the road near Cascade Locks. It looked, some said, like the butt had been used to, like, hit.
Okay, I was wondering how it got bloody.
Right, because guns are generally not.
Why?
No. No. Now, this gun ends up not being entered into evidence, but, like, a theory starts developing. Could this gun be related to the car? Mm-hmm. Could this be related to these ex-cons?
Could it all have happened at the diner?
Yes. Could something have happened?
We've pieced together a
story.
A complete, yeah.
Yeah. Now, Craven doesn't stop there. He really centers in on his suspicions about Donald. After Donald was caught stealing, he said some pretty hurtful things about his parents, specifically about their weight, and made statements about how he thought his sisters were on the same path to becoming like them.
Did Donald just fat shame his entire family?
Yes, he did.
Donald!
Right.
I'm having a really wishy-washy feeling about the entire family. Like, I love them. Wait. They did what? Donald's okay. Wait, what did he just say?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is where, like, stories get complicated,
right? Right.
Yeah. And I think, like, it's like we can't lean away from the complicated nature of these stories.
Right.
Sorry. Now, this is truly just, like, a quick summary of Craven's work because, like, he honestly became obsessed with this case. Like, this was the case that, like, he could not stop thinking about. But Okay, so Craven, he comes to believe that this gun that was found mm-hmm. was connected to Donald, that the serial number matched a gun missing from the department store in Portland where Donald had worked.
Wait, what? The gun is connected to Donald because this... Okay, how would that be... That's complicated. Can you just just tell me so what you're talking about?
Okay, this is, it gets extremely convoluted here, but and frankly continues to be homophobic.
Mm-hmm.
Now, during Craven's investigation, he learns that Donald, okay, may have had this partner in Portland, right? And that the family disapproved of him because he's male. Now, this then leads to the relationship breaking up. The family's upset. They don't want him seeing a guy, and then, you know, Donald goes east and the partner goes and gets sent away to Cascade Lakes.
Okay. So far.
Now, so in this version of the story, it would be like that the partner possibly got the gun from the department store robbery and then angered does harm to the family in retribution.
Okay, so it wouldn't have been Donald who stole the gun. It would have been Donald's ex.
Well, I think in this scenario, it's like Donald stole the gun originally, but then the ex got his hands on it,
and then he used it against Donald's family.
Yes.
Well, we're getting into like, and I mean, things like that have happened in some of the stories we talk about, but
it's a lot.
This is a lot. Yeah.
Right. So in the second scenario, so that's scenario one, if you will. In the second scenario, this one seems to be built on the belief that because of how underground a lot of LGBTQ people had to be in the 1950s, that, God, okay, this is the part of the 1950s that we just don't talk about enough, that there's like this idea that people who are LGBTQ are evil or criminal in of themselves.
I think you need to think about what you're saying, because there are people who think that right now.
Well, yes.
So, yeah, in the 1950s and right now, people think that people are part of the LGBTQ mm-hmm. plus community
mm-hmm.
are evil and criminal.
Right. Now, so this was part of, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
The 1950s kinds of things, right? And I think.
And now.
And now. And now.
You can't see Amy's face, but she looks sad.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
So part of this, these theories, this is like where these theories are born out of, right?
Mm-hmm.
Two, there's also this belief that because they're so underground and fringe, but again,
they're just lurking in the shadows.
Essentially.
Okay.
That they would be in touch with the more deviant sides of humanity. Well, they would be mixing with convicts and criminals.
Yes.
Obviously.
Because obviously.
Right.
Wanting to date a dude, hanging out with criminals and convicts. They're right. Exactly the same.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, this second concept is really built on if Donald knew the two men, Price and Light.
Oh my gosh. Because he knows all of them.
Right.
It's like when you say, like, where do you come from? And then you're like, you name a state. And then somebody's like, oh, my cousin lives in Florida. Do you know him?
You're like, no.
No, it's a very large state.
Yeah. So in this, it's this idea that, like, of course, Donald would, by him being gay, it also means that he knew these ex-cons.
Yes. Okay.
From California.
Yes. I mean, he lived briefly in Portland. It's not that far. No.
I'm from Venice.
I know.
Like, it's really, we're grasping straws.
We're really, yeah.
Now, okay, so this is all really circumstantial, but like, could Donald have hired Price and Light to do away with his family?
Mm.
Because of the strain between the family and also the fact that Donald was beneficiary of the family's home and assets.
Okay, so, I mean, at least they think he hired them and not just, like, knew them. And, like, that these two things happened.
Right, so it's like, oh, did Donald know these two and then hire them? And Was it because his family had rejected him? Slash, also, was it because he was going to get money from their estate?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, when we get down to the end of it, you better not tell me that he hired somebody.
Yeah, it's just in doing this section, God, I thought about this a lot. It's just like kind of one of those things like, well, you have to talk about this because these theories have really plagued this disappearance from the start. But also, like, we're trying to, like, pin this on Donald because, what, he's gay?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I do understand as well, it's like, we are in an era in which this is, like, replicated thought is still happening. But just, like...
Oof. Right. And I mean, honestly, him being gay aside, if he would have been in the vicinity of his family at the time of their disappearance...
Mm-hmm.
And, like, if we hadn't had, like, the phone call at Thanksgiving and the letters every 5 days and all of those things, I would say maybe they had that much of a strained relationship that he could have done it. But he wasn't even near them. He was in New York City at the time.
Yeah. So that's why
so it's like, all of it just seems like we're really, really just trying to pull stuff out of nowhere to pin it on him.
Trying to, like, put together a story.
Now. And then we're not believing the waitress, but now we are believing her because it's convenient to believe her.
Yeah.
So it's just, it's things like that. Like, we're really using this based on the convenience of it being Donald and of those criminals and the Martin family being in the same place at the same time. Like, all of this is just very, like, dreamed up.
Right. So it's just, it's like you're trying to make all these pieces fit.
Right.
Right. Now, like, this really, like, these two veins of thought, again, like, they really establish, like, some of the ongoing thoughts that still, again, still are connected to the Martin family disappearance, right? Like, it's basically, like, one of the core ideas is that they were harmed somehow, either before or after, and that their car is forced off a place in the Dales known as Trotter's Point, which was basically kind of like a viewpoint on a cliff. So this is a belief, like, that a lot of people end up holding. Now, there are also claims that there were some tire tracks found at the top of this cliff. And based on these pieces of evidence, as well as the witnesses who came forward, who claimed to have seen the Martin car in this area at the time of they disappeared, this becomes solidified that, like, essentially either, you know, these two convicts or Donald's ex-boyfriend arranged for the harm of the Martin family, and that then their car was taken to this point and shoved off into the river.
Okay.
So,
yeah. Are we ever going to find out if that's...
Well...
As we go? Yeah, okay.
Now, meanwhile, there's another group of people who they just come to believe, like, hey, like, the Martin family just happened to have, like, an unfortunate accident while on this family trip. Like, to others, like, this is the most plausible given the circumstances. And, like, let's face it, questionable 1950 safety standards when it came to things like guardrails and the like, right?
Right. And I think that when we started talking about this, that's kind of right where my mind went.
Like, they went off the road.
They went off the road. They ended up in the river somewhere.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. But not the same belief that other people had. Now,
okay.
While people speculated the winter after they disappeared, Ken's sister Charlotte, she really does begin to believe that someone harmed her family. After all, she's, like, hearing the rumors at the same time, right? So for a good part of the time, she does believe that they were harmed, although later she was like, okay, well, maybe it was an accident.
Right.
Right. Now, Donald's predictions about his family being found would prove somewhat true, like the two sisters' bodies being recovered from the Columbia River that spring. Now, given the condition of the bodies, it was believed that the two had been in deep and cold water the entire time, and that their bodies may have been dislodged from the station wagon drifting downstream until they were discovered. Some people had reported possibly seeing them drift past in the river that spring before they were found.
I doubt that.
Yeah, so it's just like, you know, like, after they're found, and then people came forward and they're like, wait, I was fishing and I saw, like, what I thought was clothing in the water.
I don't know. Wouldn't there be more damage to the bodies had that been?
Well, so they definitely had drifted. Cause like,
did they drift quite a way?
Well, you know, Susan is found 25 miles from Virginia.
Okay. So somebody that could have seen it.
Substantial. Yeah. Mm. So that's like.
Ew, imagine.
Yeah.
Well, and you would be one of those people because you admitted you wouldn't go over and look.
I'd be
so
like.
Then a few days later, you'd be like.
Maybe that was something.
Yeah. That could have been it.
That would be me.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's possible.
Yeah. Now, a few months before the discovery of Susan in Virginia, authorities had investigated tire tracks in a parking area in Cascade Locks. So different tracks than the ones at the Dales on the cliff. A comparison of these tracks to the Martin car tire type seemed to indicate that these could be from the like family's vehicle. The tracks led to the river. Authorities thought it was possible that Ken, driving the vehicle, may have accidentally, say, reversed into the cold Columbia waters on that fateful day. Finding both Virginia and Susan downriver from this location gave even more weight to this theory. Now, that's not a theory that everyone supported, because we still have the they were murdered contingent of people. Those believing that the Martin family may have been murdered, they held steadfast in their belief that the car was forced off at the Dales. Now, the coroners found undigested food in Susan and Virginia's stomachs, indicating that they'd eaten within 2 hours of their death. The food found was potato and hamburgers, which gave weight to Clara York's story that the family had dined at the snack bar in Hood River. Which then, if that's true, was it actually possible that they were there at the same time as these convicts, right?
Mm-hmm.
Also, despite coroners determining that both Virginia and Susan died by drowning, allegedly a note in Virginia's autopsy report describes a photo of her. So, like, there's a written description of a photo that indicates that there was a, quote, hole in her head. And some people believe that this opened up the possibility of a gunshot wound. And if Donald wanted to avoid suspicion for any involvement in the disappearances of his family, he wasn't doing himself any favors. He declined to return to Oregon for the memorial service for his two sisters, coming back only to settle his family's estate later in the year. Now, Detective Graven, he passes away in 1988 without solving the mystery of the Martin family's disappearance. His grandson has journals in which he wrote, "This case will be solved if I live long enough for the car and bodies to be found." Like that we will finally know the answer once we can find the remaining three of the Martin family and the car.
Ken didn't do it, did he?
I don't think so.
No.
No. I think that we're... Okay.
Okay.
I'm going to give you some more evidence, then we can...
Okay.
Okay. Now, despite extensive searches of the river, which included dive teams and grapplers, the Martin family's vehicle has never been found until perhaps now. Like Graven, diver Archer Mayo has long been fascinated with the location of the Martin vehicle. But unlike the searchers in the decades before, Mayo went about this pretty methodically. Now, one thing I forgot to mention, like, to be clear, is that there is the tugboat guy, Charles Isman, right? He actually comes for, he's like the one who found Susan's body. He actually comes forward at some point and he says that he had been in the river and that there was like a boat anchor or drilling equipment that had become stuck on something in the river at the Dales. And that when they pulled on it, that thing in the river, like it rolled a few times. And he believed, as others did, that this object was a car.
Okay.
Specifically the Martin family car. That's why a lot of the searches in the water had been centered there previously, but no one had found a car there. Now, remember, the car being there was part of the whole Martin family was murdered theory and then shoved off this cliff.
Okay, but, and Charles was back then, though.
Charles is back
then. Archer Mayo is now, yeah. Right?
Okay. So Charles and this story and the story of, you know, the Dales and the cliff and the thing in the water, that's why a lot of the search has been centered there. That this is not the direction that Archer Mayo goes. In an interview, Mayo said, "I tend to be an Occam's razor guy where I think the simplest explanation is probably right." That's why he's never bought into the various theories of foul play, but he believed that the Martin family was likely just involved in a tragic accident. He thought it'd be more likely that they'd be found near Cascade Locks. Now, there had been searches of this area too, but like these had also not shown anything. Now, in his 7 years of looking, one of Mayo's major clues was a photo of the Cascade Locks Canal while it was being constructed in the 1800s. And he found this with the help of the Oregon Historical Society. With it, he was able to see what he called a pit, which is about 90 feet long and about 20 feet deep and located on the Columbia River.
So there's like this little like notch out?
Yeah.
So it would be a perfect place for something to
settle
and get caught and not be able to go down the river. Okay.
Yeah. So like he was able to see it in these photos.
Because you wouldn't think of that being under there, like a ledge that something couldn't continue to
float down. Now seeing this, he thought that this spot downriver from where the other set of tire tracks was said to be, like that this could indicate that the Martin family car entered the river and then was moved downstream to this location by the current, like essentially falling into the pit, right, and becoming stuck. Now, in the 66 years since they've disappeared, the pit is still a pit, but it has been filled in with debris and silt. Like, it's not completely filled in, but it's just not as...
So a diver looking would just think it's another smooth spot?
Well, so it's not, like, fully filled in is my understanding, because it is quite deep. It's, like, where he was looking is about, like, 40 feet from the surface, I think. Okay. But, so it's not quite as pit.
But you wouldn't, would you see that it's 20 feet down from the rest of the river bottom?
Or would you see that there's a depression, is my understanding. Okay. I'm not an expert diver, Archer Mayo. I apologize for this. But my understanding is, like, you can tell that there's, like, stuff there, but then it's, like, kind of also filled in.
Okay. Right?
And so if you're looking around, you're not seeing anything. So, you know, we've got this pit. It's got, like, a lot of debris and silt in it.
Yeah.
Right? Now, last year, Mayo dove down on this location 60 different times. He had to use, like, machinery to move around some of the accumulated debris. And he actually does find, like, there's, like, three cars down there.
What?
I know.
Three in that one pit?
Mm-hmm. And so he discovered, though, last November, the hubcap of one. So he's, like, literally digging through the
by silt. Hand.
By hand, by, like, machine, like, digging through silt. My understanding, I read one article that said this hubcap thing is, like, 7 feet of silt down.
Wow. So really, a diver looking or just dragging the bottom normally would not even touch it. You're not,
yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Now, he was able to match this hubcap that he saw. So, like, imagine he's, like, just kind of moved around enough debris to, like, see a hubcap, right, at this point. He's compared that to what would be found on a 1954 Ford, like, the ones the Martins owned. So he was like, have I found the car? Now, this is confirmation enough that he's reported it to authorities, but he also went down to take measurements of the vehicle as he kind of, like, cleared around more. And he also was able to grab a partial license plate from the car. Now, he says the car was upside down in the water, resting on its roof, and again, below a substantial amount of debris. In addition to that, the back tailgate of the vehicle is open. So this is a station wagon, so the back is open.
How the girls slipped out?
That would be my guess, to be honest, that, like...
Just the way the water current water was, current. They just slipped out the back.
Yeah.
I know this is about the Martin car. Mm-hmm. Are you ever going to tell us about the other cars a little bit?
Yeah, so I think they're still looking at it. From my memory, I think one of them might be like a stolen car.
That was just shoved in there to get rid of it, or?
Yeah, I mean, this is actually really one of the interesting things about water recovery and what I've watched from like various dive teams, like volunteer dive teams that look for vehicles, is there is an incredible amount of vehicles in like bodies of water. Like,
it's weird when you think about it though, isn't it? Like
a shocking amount of vehicles.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Just in random bodies of water, cars and trucks and stuff.
And sometimes people and sometimes inside people. Them.
Yeah. So there have been plenty of cases in which there is a missing person and then they're just like found
inside.
But like, you know, it takes really like very often volunteer divers to actually go down and spend the time and energy to do it. So it's fascinating. Yeah. Like there was like a couple recently. I mean, their missing person's case was from, like, I think the 80s or 90s, and everyone thought they had been, like, kidnapped and murdered.
Mm.
And then they actually just, like, they found their car in the pond behind the hotel they were staying
at. Oh, wow.
So sometimes it's just, like, it's not even...
It's not even deep.
Deep.
big or?
Yeah.
Wow.
Like the Columbia is like a big, complicated river, mm-hmm. right? But like that one was just like a retention pond.
But I mean, here there are this 20 by 90 foot pit. Notch pit and there yeah. are three cars in it.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, okay. So with Mayo's work, right, that mm-hmm. brings us to March of this year, like where we are right now,
this month.
Now, on the 6th of this month, authorities moved forward with their plan to pull the car from the water. Now, Mayo himself was hesitant about this, and he's not the one who is organizing this operation, but like, obviously, he has a vested interest in finding out what happens. And he said, hey, like the visibility of the water was low because we're currently in the spring. Also with the speed of the water, it's quite fast because we're in the spring runoff mm-hmm. season. His opinion was like, they should not be pulling it now. This was not an ideal time to do it, but for some reason the sheriffs were like, it's go time.
Okay.
Now in underwater photos, which are fascinating to look at, like you can actually clearly see it is indeed a cream colored vehicle, and it is covered in debris. Like my favorite part is where he says it's covered in salmon guts. Like, is that a thing? Mm. I don't know. And you can also see the Fortomatic emblem on it. Fortomatic was like basically a type of automatic transmission touted by Ford from this era. So that seems to like things are lining up mm-hmm. right now. Reports were that the Ford was largely intact, although, again, upside down.
Mm-hmm.
Despite the length of time the vehicle has been in the water, authorities believed they could just basically safely remove it from the water with a crane. Honestly, again, following a lot of cars being pulled out of the water in missing persons cases, I'm not sure where they got this confidence from that they could just lift the whole thing from the water.
I mean, it sounds like it makes sense from someone who's never studied lifting a car from the water. I'm just like, why can't they just take it out of the water?
Yeah. Well, okay.
Why can't they?
So
I'm sure they can't, but I mean,
yeah. So over time, essentially, like even though the car looks like it's intact.
Okay.
Right. Like basically a lot of it has likely decayed. And it just doesn't like.
So will it come out in pieces more or less?
Way. Okay. Yeah. So it doesn't look that way because it's like, oh, it looks like a whole intact car. But like once you start tugging on it, like those weakened places mm-hmm. will start to give. Also, additionally, they had said that the interior of this car they knew had been filled in with some rocks, right? So like from basically stuff that had drifted into the car. So you've got like additional weight.
Okay.
As well. Now, unsurprisingly, they did have to deal with a delay in the removal of the car on Thursday because there was so much debris in the river at the time. But then they moved forward last Friday. So we're recording this on a Friday, and this is like the Friday before. Anyway, shockingly, and I say that with great sarcasm here, the car essentially does fall apart when they tried to pull it up.
Like, okay.
The crane managed to really like get the like engine and chassis, like, and the rest is like still in the water.
So the entire car still isn't out even as we record this?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know if they're planning on trying to recover the rest of the vehicle or they're just going to leave it there. Now, currently, we're like a week out from that process and everyone is waiting to hear confirmation whether or not the VIN number on the car, you know, matches the Martin car. But basically, almost everyone involved in this is certain this is the car. Now, during this, the ultimate hope, everyone's hoping for this, that the remains of Ken, Barbara, and Barbie would be found and they could be laid to rest. And honestly, like, that was my hope too, and that's why I wrote about it for the newsletter instead of first bringing it here. But divers and the team on the scene said that no human remains were found when they tried to move the vehicle.
Is it possible that they also, like, drifted out like the girls did, or is it possible that trying to get it the car up, that they could have gone more into that debris that's at the bottom?
Yeah, I mean, it really could go either way, right? Like, so one, like, visibility under there is quite limited. Even like in the photos from the scene of like the car in the water before they tried to remove it, like, it is taken up close, but you can only, it's like pretty murky. I think the visual length is about like less than like 18 inches. So like, you have to be like right on stuff to be able to see it.
Okay.
Right. So it could be possible that they just didn't see
right
them. But it's also possible, like Susan and Virginia, that their bodies drifted from the vehicle at another point and were simply not found at the same time the two sisters were. So while this may be the case where three remaining Martin family members are never located, I just wanted to use this episode as a space to remember that there was once, over 60 years ago, a family that headed out to gather holiday decorations, and their names were Kenneth Martin, Barbara Martin, Barbie Martin, Virginia Martin, and Susan Martin. The Sorrows. The Martin family missing since December 7th, 1958 from Portland, Oregon. The whole world is on fire, except the crest of smoke only drops fine ash on the water. In the shallows it pools into what can be touched and held in the palm of your hand. But deep in the cold waters, it's just constellations. There's Orion's belt twinkling in the murk, the warrior killed every night by the scorpion. The whole world can be on fire, and we'd still forget the three sisters, one to hold our sighs, one our tears, and the last our soul's darkness. What burdens we give to each to carry into the dark.
For more information about our show or to check out other shows on the network, please visit evergreenpodcast.com. Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.
Ugh, I have had no luck lately. Wait, lady luck?
Bretsky, I got you. I've had so much luck on SpinQuest.com. They have all of my favorite games, slot games, live blackjack craps, and bubble craps. You can even get a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
10 bucks for 30? I'm headed over to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.